Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, the founder and the editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Joining me is my co-host, Daniel Goldblatt, our assistant managing editor. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, Sharon. I'm a little upset that this morning you didn't ask me how my National Hot Dog Day was. I told you it was an important day for me. I wore a hot dog t-shirt and everything, and you didn't even ask how it was.
Yeah, I don't care. But I hope you had a nice time.
It was glorious. Every hot dog is.
But we have to do the news, Daniel.
Here we go. I guess so.
This week, the Hollywood production company shopping spree. Everything must go. If it feels like every company you've ever heard of in Hollywood is on the market these days, A24, Hello Sunshine, Imagine Entertainment, Legendary, that's because they are. What is fueling this frenzy? We will discuss it with Corey Martin, who's a managing partner at the entertainment law firm Granderson DeRocher, and Skylar Moore, a partner at Greenberg Lusker.
Then, Sharon, it's Comic-Con week again, which gives me an excuse to put on my nerd hat and really for have my favorite official recurring segment on the podcast, where we discuss all things fanboy with The Wrap's film reporter Umberto Gonzalez and news editor Ross Lincoln.
You enjoy that.
It is. It's a fun time. I learned so much. But first, Sharon, let's get into some headlines. You know, Fox News and its relationship with vaccines and vaccine hesitancy has made headlines all over the place this week. The network has tried to position itself as one that is promoting the vaccine, even while its biggest, Tucker Carlson, seems to undermine it at returns. Steve Ducey, during an episode of Fox and Friends this week, encouraged viewers to get the vaccine, and then co-host Brian Kilmeade immediately told viewers to make their own decision. A report this week said that Fox Corp has actually implemented a vaccine policy of sorts at its office, a concept that the aforementioned Tucker Carlson has railed against on air. Sharon, what responsibility do you think Fox News has to promote the vaccine to its viewers?
Well, more to the point, I think that it has a responsibility to present the facts to its viewers. And I don't think it has any responsibility to promote anything. But Fox News doesn't present facts. It presents a point of view and an agenda. And it feels to me like some kind of diktat has been sent down from the corporate suite, by which I mean Rupert's office, saying, oh, shit, people are really dying from this new Delta variant and the numbers are going up. And we may look like we have blood on our hands if we continue to promote this conversation about vaccine hesitancy. I mean, really, Tucker Carlson's the main guy who's going on and on about this. I don't know if there are legal implications. You got to think there must be. Maybe some lawyers are rattling their cage about what Fox's responsibility might be in finding a few choice clips. But the idea that Sean Hannity, who you didn't mention, but who also joined the chorus this week and said, I'm pro-vaccine, I'm for science, in a complete departure from the kinds of things we've heard him say for, a year and a half. It's not a coincidence. It was the same day that Steve Ducey was in favor of it. And now there's apparently these older PSAs are up on the Fox News website promoting vaccination. No coincidence here. So,
yeah, you touched on something that I feel like applies to every time we have these conversations about Fox News, which is that they separate, I'll call it church and state, but I don't know if that's not what it is, like the news operation with your Tuckers and your Hannitys and your Laura Ingrams at night, where it's like, no, we do plenty of news reporting. They're just like opinion hosts. And right. I don't think that flies anymore. Those people have an oversized amount of influence versus the rest of the news operation, right, where, you know, they are the face of the network. And if the face of your network is saying all this crazy stuff, it reflects badly on you. So I think they're trying to offset that by making sure that every other hour of the day, they seem like a responsible.
Well, Sean Hannity is part of that, but Sean Hannity is part of their star lineup. And I would say Fox and Friends is part of their, it's not prime time, obviously. It's their morning show, but it's certainly what Trump used to get up every morning and watch and often call into and whinge on or whatever about nonsense he wanted to talk about with them. Point, sometimes they looked quite uncomfortable and said, oh, Mr. President, we have to go now. Thank you very much. But the whole problem with Fox News is really complicated because, of course, we want free speech in this country, but there are broadcast standards that don't really seem to be part of the discussion of where is the line for Fox News having been given such a access to mass communication. And it is an offshoot of sort of what the responsibility is that we're talking about quite a lot as well about for Facebook, who the President Biden accused of being responsible for killing people in recent days because of the misinformation about vaccines and COVID that Facebook has permitted to propagate on its platform. And so these are, in the case of Facebook, it's a big question mark as to why they haven't taken either more aggressive measures or been transparent about the amount of traffic that these posts about with vaccine or COVID misinformation are getting. The White House has been really clear that they can't get answers out of Facebook. What's the reason for that? Doesn't seem to make any sense, but maybe they don't like what that information indicates. And Fox News's case, they absolutely duck the conversation. I mean, nobody can, it'd be great if you could get Rupert Murdoch or, you know, Lachlan to talk about what do they think their responsibility is in terms of informing the public or or allowing not credible reports to be given as much credence on their platform as others and under the cloak of opinion. These are really, really tough questions. And now they go to the life and death situations. Every time, you know, you see one of these people, Daniel, who like show up in hospital, they're like, well, I saw on Fox News, and now my dad's in the ICU. It's like,
I saw one where a guy was being interviewed. His mom was on her deathbed with COVID and they asked him, they're like, oh, well, have you been vaccinated? He's like, no. Some people you can't get through to, I guess. I don't know. Did you happen to see Marjorie Taylor Greene this week when someone asked her if she's been vaccinated? She said it was a HIPAA violation. Like, no, it's not. I don't even know what a HIPAA violation is.
But anyway, the point is like, it's, and the same thing with Tucker Carlson. He was asked by Charlotte Alter in an interview.
He said,
do I ask you what sexual positions you like to take? He was really quite obnoxious. I don't know what the point is there. Is like, are they ducking saying that they got the vaccine? And what is the point? It is Trump who actually accelerated and promoted developing a vaccine. So this whole idea that this is some kind of liberal push is completely wrongheaded. And in fact, they should flip it on its head and say Trump doesn't get enough credit for having gone on this mad, speed, goal of hitting a vaccine. That was his, like, he didn't want to do any of the other mitigation measures in the meantime, but he did want to go sort of headlong into getting a vaccine. And then that happened. It just happened after the election to his, unfortunately for him, because he could have gotten credit for it. But I guess none of it really actually makes any sense at all. And what I'm noting is that the deeper we get into this pandemic, the more people seem dug in to their vaccine hesitancy or skepticism. And we're seeing the Delta variant rise and we're seeing people back in ICUs. I'm looking at the New York Times every day and it's like up by 175% infections rising like every day. So there we are. All right, next. The billionaire space race had its latest entrant this week after Jeff Bezos flew 65 miles into the air above Texas on a spacecraft he built at his rocket company, Blue Origin. You probably noticed this. The trip followed Richard Branson's similar expedition with his Virgin Galactic rocket just 9 days earlier. Bezos and Branson were subject to a lot of criticism and a fair amount of ridicule. Yes, we all happen to notice that Bezos's missile looked very phallic. I mean, everybody noticed this. Daniel, were you outraged? Were you amused? Were you bemused? How did you take this?
So my first reaction a little bit was confusion. I thought when these guys were going to space, they were like going to space. They literally just like went up, hung out for like 10 minutes and came back. It's almost like they were going to the moon and forgot their wallet and had to come back home. I don't understand how that's like a thing. Like literally,
that's such a great metaphor. Thank you for that.
The Bezos one was like, oh, they unbuckled their seatbelts for a couple minutes, floated around, and then flew back. It was like 11 minutes. I thought this was like a real trip. But honestly, I'm going to read you a text message I sent to a couple of friends of mine, which is the degree to which I don't care about billionaires going to space is astounding. Super mega indifferent. Don't care in the tiniest bit. I don't understand why this is a big deal. I don't understand why people are outraged about it.
I think it's a big deal.
I couldn't care less.
Yeah, well, first of all, you could be outraged just by the fact that it's been shoved down our throats, right?
CNN was live with it, everyone.
Yeah, a huge media event was made out of this. And okay, let's take our own id and natural skepticism of billionaires out of it. It is perhaps the beginning of space tourism. I guess I won't even say perhaps. It is the first step in eventual potential space tourism. So there's that. I do remember there was used to be supersonic travel in here on Earth, and that went away. So just because they've taken a first step in that direction doesn't mean it actually happens. But more to the point, I think the outrage was, I mean, first of all, the very obvious sort of dick measuring contest of having two phallic shaped missiles go up and down in 10 minutes and everybody jumping up and down was like completely unavoidable. And could you get any more on the nose with that? But at the same time, we are experiencing catastrophe everywhere here on Earth. And so when we're having floods in Germany in the middle of the summer with 150 people disappearing, and we're having wildfires in Oregon that are creating fire tornadoes and that are actually changing weather patterns and putting the lives of firefighters and the homes of thousands of people at risk. How much more do I go on? I can go on. When we're talking about seeing buildings collapse suddenly out of nowhere and 150 people buried beneath the rubble because of our crumbling infrastructure, should I stop there? It's a shit show here on Earth, and I don't think anybody feels like, oh, the billionaires are paving the way to save us. They feel like their resources are going into their own private, you know, ego trips. I think that's
I think so. And then you get into the taxes debate, which everyone brings up every time, which I don't understand how you're mad at a billionaire for not paying taxes. Shouldn't you be mad at the government for creating a system that allows them to not create taxes?
I think every human on earth
would pay zero taxes if they could. Like, I don't know. That never really tracked with me, but again.
Well, it's not as if billionaires don't put any effort into making sure that they don't pay taxes. They pay off politicians and they get people elected to office who will do their bidding. So
I would probably do the same taxes. Yeah, makes sense to me.
So anyway.
All right. Finally, this week, Bill O'Reilly undertook some very strong legal measures to silence Andrea Macris, the former producer who settled a sexual harassment lawsuit in 2004 with the then Fox News star. Macris, after speaking with the Daily Beast last week in violation of the non-disclosure agreement she signed at the time of the settlement, was supposed to appear on The View on Wednesday, but O'Reilly and his lawyers intervened in the form of a restraining order, forcing ABC to cancel Macris's appearance. And after that cancellation, Macris told the Daily Beast, quote, "I hope the days of the law allowing the silencing of women are over. I will continue to fight for my voice," end quote. Sharon, Macris got $9 million to settle her suit with O'Reilly. Do you have any issue with her now deciding to ignore the NDA that she signed?
I mean, I think I'll take the unpopular position here that I think that if you've signed an NDA and somebody wants to enforce it, then that's the law and we follow the law. If Andrea Macris wants to abrogate her NDA because she feels a moral imperative to do so, she should do that, but she should also be prepared to pay the consequences for doing that.
Yeah, I think this is one of those examples where there are certain things that in general I'm opposed to, but in specific, I might have a different feeling. I think NDAs are terrible and they're used throughout the years, especially by terrible people who silence victims. But if you signed one and you took the money, you made that decision. And to your point, she can violate it, but there are going to be consequences, and this is that. And, you know, it's an interesting point about the news organizations knowing that she has this NDA or if they're in some sort of violation in some ways, because that's where
I don't care at all. Our job as news organizations is to get the news out. It's not our problem.
If someone
NDA, that's their decision.
Yeah. So if someone you knew had an NDA wanted to speak out, you'd be fine.
100%. I think I'm sure we have in all of the YouTube coverage that we did. I'm sure that there were people who were under NDA. As you know, the first person who I believe among the first people to talk to Zelda Perkins, who was Harvey's assistant in New York, in London, and she would not. I spoke to her, but literally it was like, would you like some milk with your tea kind of conversation? And I heard you were raped by Harvey Weinstein, or you had some sexual encounter with Harvey Weinstein. You got paid for it. And she's like, I'll have milk with my tea. That was like, so, she was afraid of what an NDA would do. And for sure, had she spoken to me, and that was back in 2005, she would have felt the wrath of Harvey and all the lawyers he could possibly hire to come after her. So, I think my hope would be that women would feel confident and strong and supported enough to not sign the NDA and take the money and to speak their truth in the full light of day or in court, if that's the place, if that's the right forum for it.
Yeah, I agree. I think I would like to see something done about NDAs in general, but once you've signed, I don't know what else to say. All right. Finally, this week, as always, we like to conclude this first segment with a little something we call Wax On, Wax Off, where we allow our founder and editor-in-chief, Sharon Waxman, the opportunity to speak out about something she is particularly into this week, her Wax On, and something she's a little more fired up about, a little more upset about, a little more angry about, her Wax Off.
Sharon, I never find anything to be angry about, Daniel. What are you talking about? Yeah, all right.
The floor is
yours.
Here
we go. My Wax On this week is a big hat tip to a lady I never heard of before this week. Her name's Catrice Hardy. She is the editor of the Indianapolis Star. She just won a Pulitzer Prize, and she is now going to be the editor of the Dallas Morning News, which, by the way, is a paper I used to freelance for when I lived in Europe and was a great paper to work for. She is the first woman to hold that position. She is the first Black person to hold that position. She seems extremely cool and talented, and I just want to say shout out to you, Catrice Hardy. Godspeed, good luck, and lucky you over in Dallas. That's my Wax On. My Wax Off is, I was so surprised to see that our good Hollywood friend Tom Barrack has been arrested and indicted and is in jail here in Los Angeles. This is a guy who's got billions of dollars, houses in Malibu, boats, as far as I know, because I remember talking to him once he was on his boat. He is part of the barnacles that attach themselves to the cancerous Trump starship, and has now been indicted for literally actually spying for the United Arab Emirates while being Trump's lead fundraiser for the 2016 race, and also chairing the really crappy inauguration. Tom, that wasn't your fault. None of the performers wanted to show up, which we wrote about a lot of the time. But like, to me, Tom Barrack is a guy who should be enjoying his retirement, enjoying his grandchildren, enjoying his money. But the lure, the greed of what was dangled to people in Trump's orbit and the environment where it was just anything went. You could do anything. Like, he was flying to Marrakesh to meet one of the rulers of the UAE to cut this deal, to become their representative inside Trump world, while there was this meeting at Trump Tower going on that also became a question of influence peddling with the Russians, as you recall. There was a lot of talk about that. So what's in this indictment is, which I have only looked at bits of, is tons of actual evidence, texts, emails. It's completely shameless and brazen. And I am quite sure that people like Tom Barrack and others like him who have been indicted, there's like a half a dozen of them. Some of them are in jail right now, like Paul Manafort, actually pardoned, so out, but okay. Who then lied to the FBI, like thought, not only can I brazenly take money, $1.5 billion billion dollars from the UAE funneled into Tom Barrack's investment companies, vehicles, in exchange for, they're calling him an agent. I don't want to say he's just an influence peddler, because apparently if you're an agent, that's like actually pretty close to a spy. Not that the UAE is a hostile foreign power to us, but still, it impacts policy and it screws with, kind of a sensitive region, the Middle East. I don't know. And it just shows you that the power of greed that kicked in around the Trump administration like knew no bounds. So Tom Barrack, I am sorry that you're in jail, man, but wow, what were you thinking?
You didn't sound very sorry. You sounded
You kind of feel bad because he's just like a rich guy who just decided he needed to get richer. He was already rich. How much more money did you need? And he probably would tell you today, I'm going to take a wild guess, that he's like, I would never rat out the United States. I would never do anything that would hurt the United States. I was just helping out my friends in the United Arab Emirates. It's just that, wow.
Yeah, not the best decision. All right, that does it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, we're going to dive into the rash of production company sales talks, and we're going to go full nerd and preview Comic-Con 2021.
Yay.
Stay tuned.
It's starting to feel like every production company in Hollywood has a giant for sale sign hanging out front, and why not? With the price tags being floated around these days, $3 billion for A24? Are you kidding me? You'd be foolish not to at least listen to offers. And if you have a celebrity as the face of your studio, like Reese Witherspoon's Hello Sunshine or LeBron James' Spring Hill, then you can ask for a lot more than you're probably worth. What is causing the sudden surge in the marketplace? Here to help us make sense of it are Corey Martin, the managing partner at the entertainment law firm Granderson DeRocher, and Skylar Moore, a partner at Greenberg Glusker. Welcome, you guys.
Welcome. Thank you.
Okay, so let's jump in and start with why, for those who are the uninitiated, why is this happening right now? Sky, let's start with you. Why all of these production companies in the news about being for sale?
I tend to think it's Hollywood talk. I think there'd be more to talk about if they were actually sold than people running around getting numbers. I mean, I've sold a lot of companies in the last several years, and it's grounded in reality, and I can tell you how valuations are done, but the numbers that I've been hearing are just, you know, it's fantasy talk. It's Hollywood where they add a few zeros. So I don't think it's really news until in fact something sells.
Corey, what do you think?
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I would just add, and I think what Skylar was probably alluding to is sometimes it's the lie that becomes the truth. And if you kind of create the allure of a particular marketplace that you're trying to, reach a particular valuation, sometimes, the reality, it may bring that to reality. I will say this much. Based upon a lot of the conversations that I've been having with clients of mine, both those who were looking to raise capital and others who were considering potential M&A in terms of a potential sale opportunities, I can tell you that there's certainly been an influx of outside capital, whether institutions, obviously we could talk a bit about SPACs and the impact that that's had on the overall marketplace. But I think that the influx of capital into the media landscape in general, and particularly the content landscape, has really added to the fervor. I like to kind of refer to it as silly season. I think we're at the point in the life cycle where there are frothy valuations, but until some of these things actually get closed, they're just valuations on paper and not valuations in reality.
So I'm going to quote you guys back to yourselves in a year from now, silly season and fantasy Hollywood. But it is true. First of all, I mean, I totally agree with you. These valuations make no sense. But I was one who was on the record when Legendary sold however many years ago to China that made no sense at all either. And the deal happened. So just because it didn't make sense doesn't necessarily mean it's not going to happen. But the reality is, and I think Corey, it was you who was quoted in our story this week saying that, you know, you used to go to Hollywood to rich and then lose all your money investing. But these production companies do have value now, right? In a way that you probably wouldn't have seen maybe 3, 4, and 5 years ago. So let's talk about why that is.
Yeah. And I think, look, I think I provided the truncated quote. I think the actual quote is, the best way to become a millionaire in Hollywood is to start off as a billionaire.
For sure.
What I would say is that a lot of institutions, so in my practice, I represent companies that are, you know, that create content, that are production companies, et cetera. But then I actually came from a M&A corporate finance background prior to getting involved in entertainment. And so in that capacity, I've worked with private equity firms and family offices. And a lot of those private equity firms and family offices wouldn't look at anything in the entertainment or media landscape. They wouldn't look at film and television opportunities. They wouldn't look at opportunities in music. They wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole because there was a perception that entertainment was where investors, you know, went to die. And I think that the annuity value, they've kind of woken up to the annuity value of various types of content. And in the article in which I was quoted earlier this week, one of the things that I mentioned is that a lot of this is being driven by the impact of the streamers. The fact that, you know, Netflix and Amazon and the others are going to spend billions upon billions of dollars on content for many years into the future. And therefore, the traditional metrics around, you know, what a successful theatrical project, a motion picture project looks like in terms of back-end participations and the like, you know, what a successful television project looks like in terms of renewals and those sorts of things, it somewhat goes out the window when you have these buyers in the marketplace that have a voracious appetite for content. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it's really that kind of rising tide lifts all the ships sort of dynamic that makes the A24s, the Hello Sunshines, these other production companies that much more valuable, at least on paper.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, because again, that quote that Sharon mentioned about losing money reminded me a lot of sports ownership, which I feel like used to be just a vanity thing. And then all the leagues saw such exponential growth that you found that you could make hundreds of millions of dollars. And I think that ties in a little bit to these celebrity-fronted production companies where it feels like these valuations are inflated because it would be cool to be in business with LeBron James. It would be cool to be in business with Reese. Do you think there's anything, Skylar, I'll ask you, really behind these celebrity production companies, or is it just name value?
Let me try to address. I think there's several things going on. One is, if you're selling the company, where you're walking away and you're just selling it, the buyers are not crazy, and they're going to look at three things. They're going to say, what basically it's an EBIT calculation. What are your earnings? And the you know, multiples get a little bit crazy now and then, but the usually it's around 10 times earnings. And so they'll say, what is your earnings? Which is going to depend on what are their participations? What do they own? For example, mm-hmm. Hello Sunshine has Big Little Lies. You know, I don't know what revenue they're getting from that, but somebody was just going to pencil it out and say, okay, we expect to get, you know, blank, and we'll present value that. Then the question is, what development projects do they own? And typically you value that at cost. They don't usually mark that up. And then the third thing is future services. Are these people committing to do future films? And that's a whole different ballgame. And so for, you know, if the number, that becomes really an investment in the company, which is totally different than a sale. So if what Reese Witherspoon is saying, or LeBron James, if they're saying, I will continue to produce, act, whatever, they can enter into service agreements that go for as long as 7 years in California. And then the question is, what is the value of the, they're not getting the money directly. Typically it's an investment in their films. And so that may be what's going on. What you often see in Hollywood is somebody will go out and they'll get $1 million loan, and then they'll say it's to invest in a film. And then they'll say, yeah, but I could do 100 films, and therefore I just raised $100 million. And they're not getting 100 million, but at best 100 million is being invested in film production. you could, and you've seen this, you've, you know, definitely Netflix has stood behind some big producers and invested in their films, and those numbers get a little bit crazy. But so that may be what's going on, but
that would, that still wouldn't pencil out.
It wouldn't pencil out. So I just think the numbers are not what I'm seeing. I mean, I've been buying companies and, you know, routinely, and the numbers are not crazy. I will tell you, we just closed some deals and it's definitely not crazy at all. It would just,
and what's the size of the deal? Let's say, if you won't tell us the company,
I won't get into deals, but we're talking $50 million, to $100 million. Right. We're talking
these are like production companies, the same kind of companies,
production/distribution companies that own rights and sell and
have cash flow,
and product and rights. And, yep. And, you know, we just get out our calculator and you pencil it out and you argue about the value, but there's certainly not wild valuations.
Okay. Well, the difference between 100 million and 1 billion is an awful lot. I mean, it just it feels like zeros, but my goodness. I mean, when I saw that, you know, we reported on Imagine having a number of suitors, and it feels to me like if you were looking to buy a premium production company, Imagine Entertainment's got to be the number, you know, your first stop if Brian Grazer and Ron Howard would ever want to sell it, which I do now think they are prepared to sell it. They're both, by the way, like towards the end of their careers, and it's would be smart for them to take the money off the table. And they're also smart enough to see that we're in this kind of, you know, crazy market that they should not miss that moment. But I mean, that would be a place that I would think if you wanted to talk about $1 billion still would feel like a lot, but at least they have so many. Yeah, they have so many deals and so many hit films and so many other things. Anyway, that they're talking under $1 billion, like $850,000, which is a lot of money. But that was what I like when I saw Reese Witherspoon, and, you know, I love Reese and I love Sarah Harden, who runs her company. And I think Reese, by the way, Dan, I don't want to like dismiss her as somebody who's just like a celebrity face. Reese is involved in developing things. She has a very good head on her shoulders. She has very good taste, and she also stars in them. So she's not like, you know, window dressing. She's very involved in her company, but still, I didn't understand at all how they got to a number like a billion.
Well, look, let me just add one thing. You know, my takeaway from the information that's been publicly disseminated about, you know, Spring Hill, Hello Sunshine, et cetera, was that they were seeking $1 billion.
Yeah,
and
good point.
A lot of that is
good point.
Driven by the bankers, whose job it is to get the highest possible price, may have a range of potential investors/acquirers that they're reaching out to. And they will say, look, if you want to win this transaction, this is the number that you need to come up with. Hmm. Again, until such time, however, as one of these have closed, then it's just a headline. It's not really a story. From my point of view.
Well, I do want to ask about, you know, you're talking about private equity and family offices investing. What about strategics that have now kind of the only merger that's awaiting still to be done is apparently Viacom, NBC Universal, you know, merging. I guess that's supposed to happen. That's, I've had like five people tell me, yeah, that's going to happen. Yeah. So I guess it is to be able to compete. But Are the strategic, are Apple, Amazon, Netflix going to be buying more of the production companies, do you guys think?
Yes, they will. But again, the prices are not going to be insane. Yes, they are. Yeah, they are.
They are. Can you tell us more? I really am curious.
can't discuss details, but yes, they are.
I mean, look, those, you know, Amazon, Netflix, Apple, I mean, they have very sophisticated M&A professionals who understand what the overall strategy and objectives are,
right?
Those companies, and they're always actively in the market looking for targets to acquire. So that's just going to be a constant. They will be continually acquisitive.
Are these Middle Eastern states, are they like first in line to buy these things? They have endless, unlimited cash, and by which I mean Abu Dhabi or UAE or Qatar. I guess Saudi Arabia's been out there spreading money around. Are they going to buy these things?
they're more into film. I'm handling a couple of those. They're more into film production. So they're not out to buy companies because they don't have the management capacity to handle them from, you know, the Middle East, but they are actively investing in companies, and in particular, it's often with their own films, often to do a film that has, it's like soft power, the same way China was investing to do soft power. So is the Middle East right now.
But you say in U.S. films, not in films that are being made.
Both. We're doing films right now that are English language, but with a, let's call it a Middle East spin, so that they are, again, to me, I view it as the same as China doing the soft power. But they're investing big in films. Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting. It looks like there's not going to be a whole lot left out there that's not owned by some financial entity. You know, used to be that Hollywood was a place where kind of a creative maverick could come and create their own world, you know, that's what goes back to the origins of Hollywood.
The independent days are over. I really think that's over. It's a streaming world. And what I tell clients is either you get on your knees and sell to a streamer up front or just face the fact you're going to lose your money.
Yeah. And I tell my clients, either you sell to a streamer now or you sell to a streamer later.
Yes. Fair.
Wow.
Yes. If you're lucky. And the problem with later is often they don't like the later because they want to feel that it's their film up front.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we would be wise to listen to you two guys. You're right. You're right in the thick of it. And, I want to reach out to my friend Van Toffler, who just wrote a piece, who used to run MTV and Comedy Central and created many wonderful things on that network, and who speaks up on behalf of independent creators. You guys just threw some rain on his parade, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for joining us. We'll have you on again. I hope to check in on this down the road.
Yeah. Well, after the sales are made, I'll bet there'll be a few zeros missing.
I bet you're right.
Okay.
Thanks, Guy. Thanks, Corey.
Thank you.
All the best. Cheers.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Bye.
Comic-Con is once again upon us, though it is still in its at-home state due to the pandemic, but it's still as good a reason as any to check in on the world of nerd pop culture and all things fanboy with the resident expert on the topic, film reporter Humberto Gonzalez, news editor Ross Lincoln. Thank you for joining us. By the way, in the intro, I described this as my favorite unofficial recurring segment that we have on the podcast. And it's not just because Sharon's not here. all right. So Comic-Con is remote, which means you guys are here in LA and not coming to us live from San Diego.
Yeah.
We carry on anyway. But like for those of us that don't follow it too closely, what are the biggest announcements, news, et cetera, that we can expect to hear coming out of Comic-Con this weekend?
This, a big shrug emoji. It's no mostly...
I like that. I like being not in the... when everything's embargoed and I know everyone. I want to be surprised.
Yeah, what you can count on is there won't be anything mind-blowing. None of the major studios, the major studios are having almost zero content there. Disney did its whole thing at the Investors Day. Time is a flat circle at this point. I believe that was in December, where they rolled out all of their upcoming Marvel and Star Wars content, Pixar stuff. And as a result, they have nothing to announce and nothing to show off other than occasionally reminding people to sign up for Disney Plus, which everyone did. Warner Brothers also bowing out for the most part. There are going to be a couple of CW shows there. I think Legends of Tomorrow has a panel. But otherwise, no DC Comics content to speak of. Last year, Warner Brothers did what do they call it? Fandome. It was like a two-day
event. I think that's the last time we all got together for this.
Yeah, Fandome. It was like a two-day event. It was really fun compared to the first Comic-Con at home. There was a lot of really cool stuff. They're doing that again, but they're doing it in October. So basically, Comic-Con at home this year. If you love Comic-Con, log on and watch, but don't expect there to be anything breaking the internet coming out of this. I think it's going to be strictly for fans and nothing else.
So they are actually still though planning an in-person event, but confusingly for Thanksgiving weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Umberto, are you going to show up for that? What do you think it's going to work?
I don't think it's going to work, and I think as we get closer, they're going to eventually postpone. Because think about it, you got to, before an actual con has to take place, you have to have your vendors show up, your exhibitors show up. If there's going to be any construction, like putting up, getting grips down there and lighting technicians to put these stages together, and all those guys, I'm pretty sure, are going to be home with their families on Thanksgiving weekend. On top of it, with airlines raising their fares, it's also the most expensive time of the year to travel.
Yeah.
The economy being in the pandemic crunch right now, I don't think it's economically feasible to do a Comic-Con that weekend. Like, publicists have been on record saying they're not going to send talent there, or they're not going to spend their Thanksgiving weekend babysitting talent out there. And then talent on themselves, I'm not going to participate. So it sounds, for lack of a better term, like an unmitigated disaster.
So, yeah. It's certainly like, why of all the weekends you could pick to have your in-person special event in the fall, big comic convention, why they'd pick Thanksgiving over, say, Halloween, it just blows my mind. It's for all the reasons you just said, and also it's not like there's any competition on Halloween. LA Comic-Con, no offense to LA Comic-Con, which is a really fun time, is really not a competition to Comic-Con. I don't mean that to diminish it. I mean, it's like a completely different, they serve completely different audiences. There's a little bit of overlap with cosplay, but really it's two different events. They'd lose nothing. I think the other thing though is the Delta variant. I think COVID is, I mean, look, we're all vaccinated, I assume. I don't want to make it appear that I'm scared.
Ross, actually, that question was a violation of my HIPAA.
Oh,
right?
Sorry. Yeah, I forgot. Yeah, HIPAA, whatever. my apologies, Congresswoman Green. I don't want to give the false impression that I'm out there quaking my boots. Like, I'm going to personally be sick. Vaccines work. Everyone should get them. But the Delta variant's extremely contagious, and we're seeing a small, but you know, not insignificant number of breakthrough infections from people who are vaccinated, and it's just cutting through unvaccinated people like butter. We don't know what that's going to look like by the time we get to October, but I suspect that we're going to see, just for that reason alone, not even like the Thanksgiving thing, just the, I don't know how safe I feel. Who's going to be, what happens if we get to fall and there's an even worse explosion of this? Hopefully the vaccine gets FDA approval, like officially, instead of the emergency use authorization, at which point it might be easier to start doing vaccination mandates. But I think we're going to get closer to Thanksgiving, and it's, that's the reason it's going to not happen at all.
I can't believe someone not only suggested Thanksgiving weekend, but then went to their boss and was like, yeah, there's just one problem. I picked Thanksgiving weekend. And the guy went, okay, that's fine. Like, yeah. Who thought of this?
Just
blows my mind. You mentioned DC Fandom, which is such a great event last year. Speaking of DC, Umberto, you actually broke the news this week. Leslie Grace has been cast as Batgirl in an upcoming film. What can you tell us about her and this particular project?
Well, it's funny, before I start with the DC Fandom, in my opinion, was the best online fan or Comic-Con experience.
Yeah, it was a blast.
And, and I'm sure they're prepping for it now, and I'm eager to see what they have going on in October. Had there been a normal Comic-Con this week, we would have probably gotten Leslie Grace, singer-songwriter. My own mother put me onto her years before she got cast in the movie. Hey, I'm half Dominican by my mother and half Colombian by my dad. So got the call from a source. Hey, you know, I've been tracking, as I track all the superhero projects aggressively, and there were a few ladies testing, as and I put in my pitches last week. I've been tracking, so it came down to two contenders: Haley Lou Richardson and Leslie Grace. So Leslie Grace, I think she played Nina Rosario recently in The Heights. She was one of the breakout stars of that. Great actress, great singer. And then she won over the DC executives. And it's like, she's going to, according to a source internally, she's going to make a great Barbara Gordon. So literally, I found out, quite frankly, before she did. And we went with the news, and it exploded online. So happy to see some representation on that front, because Leslie Grace now marks the third Latina to be cast in a DC superhero project following Sasha Kale, who's Colombian, playing Supergirl in The Flash. Also, Rachel Zegler, which we exclusively broke, who's also Colombian. She's going to star in West Side Story later this year's Maria. She's playing one of the witches in the upcoming Shazam Fury of the God sequel. And now Leslie Grace, being Dominican-American from the Bronx of all places, and headlining as Barbara Gordon, which is a huge, huge step for diversity and inclusion. But what I like that this regime is very intent on the diversity front. But also, they like Warner Brothers, a lot of these studios like to work with the same people. They tend to cast the same actors in the same movies if they had a good experience working with them previously. So I think it's a great piece of casting. She looks fabulous, and I think she's going to kill the role. So we'll be excited to see what happens next year on HBO Max.
You know, I have a question about this that I don't know the answer to, and I doubt there is one, but obviously, there has been a decentralization, canonically speaking, in DC's movies. You know, they're obviously going to do the Flash movie is obviously going to be explicitly be about multiverse stuff. But we just have to assume at this point that all of these projects sort of exist in their own universes, and they'll take what they want and use it however they want. I'm curious if you've heard or if you know, just an educated guess, if this new version of Batgirl is going to ever be reused? Like, will she show up in like a Birds of Prey sequel, or will they eventually link her to whatever the next canonical version of Batman ends up being? What do you know about that?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if she does make appearances in other DC IP. They're all about creating their multiverse right now, and the Flash movie, for something if listeners haven't heard, will reset the DC universe timeline and metaverse and set everything in order after. That's going to be the most important movie of this regime. They got Batman now in the can. Black Adam's almost done shooting. The Rock wrapped his role. The Flash is currently shooting. They got to go into Aquaman 2. They got Shazam 2 shooting. Like, this is the busiest I think DC has been in years. So as we saw earlier, I think last year in the CW Flash, when Ezra Miller made an appearance on the Flash Arrowverse show.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. So I have a feeling we're going to be seeing a lot more of that. And these days, actors, you know, when they sign their deals, they usually have a step or two that they can make an appearance somewhere else or be using another property or another movie or TV show. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see her maybe in the future, in the years to come, in another DC movie or another DC project.
Yeah.
Do you know, I'm still mildly boycotting The Flash because I really like Grant Gustin and I thought he should have stayed in the role. I don't like Ezra Miller personally, but I feel like I'm going to have to watch it because it's going to be that good.
Yes. But,
in my mind, not protesting, because I think Grant Gustin's fantastic on The Flash.
I mean, it's show. Weird how long it took both Marvel and DC to understand that television's not an afterthought. It's also not competition, but it's all something that can work together. Obviously, Marvel Television used to be an entirely distinct entity from Marvel Studios, and there was a whole lot of behind the scenes reasons why they did not get along so great. And so Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. pretty much was an alternate universe after its second season. But the CW shows were the first time, I would argue, since Batman Begins. I don't like The Dark Knight. I'm sorry, everybody. Please eviscerate me. I think it's a fascist garbage. It's got cool performances, and Heath Ledger deserved his Oscar. But I'm not a big fan of The Dark Knight. I think Batman Begins is possibly the best Batman movie. It's fantastic. And I feel like the CW shows were the first time that you really started, people had a real handle on what it is that makes DC Comics so interesting. And part of it is DC's comics are so tonally weird because so many different independent comic companies and properties have sort of been absorbed by DC over the years. And they just sort of like graft them to the DC universe. So you have like, you know, post 1970s Batman existing in the same universe with Shazam. And it can lead to some really weird stuff. Like you get a really serious character, a really corny character, and you make them friends and you don't know why it works, but it just does. And CW shows got that energy really well. They also got the energy of just how like, screw it, magic and science made somebody run really fast. They don't even try to make it like grounded. And the DC movies over the last decade or so tried really hard to lean in on this idea of like realism. I think, sorry to be dorky, but I think a lot about like why Superman.
Oh, way too late for that.
Yeah, true. Good point. Okay, so like super real briefly, rest in peace, Richard Donner, by the way. The Richard Donner Superman the movie remains the best DC Comics movie ever made. It's fantastic for a number of reasons, but like if you read a million things that other people have written about it, the thing that you'll take away from it is that while he was making the movie, they basically were like obsessed with the concept of verisimilitude. Like they didn't want to like make it realistic. They wanted it to feel real, which is a completely different thing. They didn't like spend too much time trying to explain Superman's powers. They just tried to make it believable that we were watching, you know, you will believe a man can fly was the tagline. And that was the whole thing. And that to me feels like the energy of DC. You will believe a rich guy with bows and arrows can fight crime. You will believe a time traveling billionaire's close friends with a fire based criminal. I don't know. The CW shows are really good. They were the redheaded stepchild of DC for a long time. I was really happy when they did that crossover just because it was the acknowledgement that like they weren't going to like cut the CW shows off from the stuff that people are really interested in anymore. I'm actually bring it. If we get both Ezra Miller and Grant Gustin continues, I think they can both live in harmony. Thanks for coming to my TED Talk.
Yeah. You know, I'm just going to say, I don't think your Dark Knight take is that terrible. I think every scene that Heath Ledger isn't in is awful. And
I disagree there.
Yeah, no, I don't think the movie stands without him for a second, but that's a whole other podcast. I want to close with this. You guys, as I've said, you're my touchstones for this topic. You're what I go to know what's going to be interesting and good and fun. What's the next thing? I'll allow each of you one. What's the next thing I should be on the lookout for to get into in this universe? A show we're looking forward to, a movie. I personally loved the first Shazam. I'm so excited for the second one. But I think we're still a ways from that. But is there anything else in the next month or two where you're like, ooh?
I mean, Ms. Marvel is the thing that I'm looking forward to the most that's coming out this year. I'm a huge fan of that comic. They're also bringing characters into that we're going to see in other productions. I don't want to say too much and interrupt to be wrong, but I will say that like seeing Marvel start to dig into some of the weirder stuff from the Marvel universe and more sort of almost corny in a good way stuff is delightful to see. Loki felt really just endearing unashamedly a lot. And I'm looking forward to seeing hopefully more of that moving forward. But also Ms. Marvel's just a cool concept. I mean, she can grow and shrink parts of her body and punch you with a giant fist. It's ridiculous. It makes no sense. It's just beautiful to look at.
Umberto, anything on your radar you're excited about?
To see where Marvel takes Phase 4. I'm excited to see Shang-Chi opens in September, and then Eternals. But then on the DC front, you know, Batman, which I'm hearing great things about as they're putting it together, editing and putting the final touches. I can't wait for that to drop next year, I think in the spring. So very excited for that.
I almost forgot about that Pattinson one because it got delayed so many times because of COVID.
I'm a huge fan of Zodiac Killer Riddler. That's like so obvious, and it wasn't thought of before.
I didn't understand that, but I'm excited.
No, I mean like their version of the Riddler is clearly like inspired by the Zodiac Killer. You know, like the idea of like a clues leaving murderer taunting the cops is finally there. That's it.
I actually just rewatched Zodiac recently. That's funny.
Nice.
All right, Umberto, Ross, thank you as always for making me a little smarter in this particular genre. Always a pleasure to talk to you guys. Thank you for coming on.
Okay. Thank you for having us.
And that is it for this week's episode of The Wrap-Up. Thank you to all of our listeners. And remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time.